Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 83, section 8, which is old single column, page 929. Okay, we have this final section of 83 when we roll over into the third of the three papers. And recall that we went through that that section, entitled the Dissolution of Marriage, at the end of the preceding session. So we went through all of the those issues of what's held marriages together. To some degree, no matter how arbitrary, over the millennia, what some of the issues were that behind that disruption of the relationship, and remember, one of the key elements that they brought in was how challenging it is to have a stable marriage institution when you bring in all of the very energetic notions that are predicated on individual romance. There may very well be some valid senses to which they are those so-called ideals genuinely are ideals, but it brings in a lot of volatile energy that for most of human history wasn't there. And so they want to focus on that specific issue in this final section of the paper, how the more spiritual humans have gotten, the more we bring in so-called ideality in everything we do. The more that we'll have a tendency to say, well, this is the ideal job for me, this is the ideal route to work, this is, we start bringing in that, those more existentialized, if not literally existential, concepts, in just all sorts of areas. Like, we always talk about the tendency to make something an ism, to take an idea and juice it up into an ism. And, we'll see as we get into this a little bit, it's, as I was just hinting, even if you don't literally bring in eternity in the existential, you can bring it in, let's say in a downstep sort of fashion. Let's just say it that way. That adds just a whole new complexity to an appropriate thing to do, and hence the other side of the blade, an inappropriate thing to do. The very fact that that reality is hierarchical, that there isn't this absolute dichotomy, kind of the way humans thought in the past with, it's either heaven or earth, that sort of simplistic binary thinking. Like I was just saying, it means you have to be all the more sophisticated in thinking about things and not overplaying them, because you don't just bring in the spiritual, you don't just bring in the Father, let's say. You bring in that downstepping functioning of the Mother, and hence a whole hierarchy of modes of functioning and flavors of concept. Okay. All right. So let's think about this here a little bit more precisely. Let's see what they've got to say.
Section 8, the idealization of marriage. Marriage, which culminates in the home, is indeed man's most exalted institution, but it is essentially human. It should never have been called a sacrament. The Sethite priests made marriage a religious ritual, but for thousands of years after Eden, mating continued as a purely social and civil institution.
Okay, so we don't even get out of the first paragraph, and we're already seeing some precision that if you haven't mastered, you're going to stumble over. I mean, literally, you know, juxtaposed, they have the statement, it should never have been called a sacrament. And then they, you know, immediately follow that with, the Sethite priests made marriage a religious ritual. Okay, so, yeah, but let's, you know, before we get to that, you know, specifics, let's, you know, appreciate the full beginning paragraph here. Marriage which culminates in the home. So they're bringing in kind of the fullness of this. You know, we stressed way up front that when we're talking about marriage in the Urantia book, we're talking about male-female mating pairs institutionalized for the purpose of procreation and the social regulation of that phenomenon. Okay, but we didn't put right up front, and the home is a given in that. So you know, you can take it to that next step. Marriage, not just mere marriage, you might say, see, but marriage which culminates in the home. That's kind of the fullness of what we're reflecting on, to get that full foundational aspect of civilization in play. You know, it's not just marriage. Marriage which culminates in the home. Without any qualification, is indeed man's most exalted institution. So right there, most exalted, you're thinking, well, doesn't that say it's just full of spiritual fact? I mean, if it's most exalted, you know, but then they say, but it is essentially human. And then they say, it should never have been called a sacrament. It's like, oh man, I'm, you know, this is like watching a tennis match. I'm bouncing back and forth. I can't figure out what side of the line I'm on here. You know, so right away, you need that precision. But it is essentially human, bottom up from the humus. Right? If you start with that, then you won't get so confused. And so when they say, it should never have been called a sacrament. Oh, what they're meaning is not to think of it as something that's, you know, a downwelling fact. You know, when they're saying sacrament, you know, there's something sacred, you know, about this. It's like, well, isn't it sacred? It's indeed man's most exalted institution. Doesn't that make it sacred? Like, well, okay, maybe from the bottom-up sense, but not from the top-down sense. It's not divinely sacred. See, that's what's between the lines there, to put that together properly. That's what they mean by it. And then when they say the Sethite priests made marriage a religious ritual, and they don't seem to say, and boy, that was the beginning of the problems. That isn't what the follow-up is. You know, they seem to be holding that up as a positive. Like, okay, well, let me think about that. That most exalted. I mean, you know, I am reaching up in a very definitive way. And if I remind, you know, if my religion or the religious functioning of my society reminds me that there's God above. And if the husband and wife each are in and of themselves in their inner life reaching up to God, that will allow the most transcendent superadditive consequence possible through their relationship. So that's what the Sethite priests had in mind, you can see interpret between the lines, they were trying to remind them of, now, not that God is joining them together, but that don't forget that God can help to hold you together. You know, if each of you consecrate yourself and your inner life to that nucleus, you know, sharing the inner life with God. Okay, so that's what the Sethite priests were doing, and see, and you can tell that because of what they say, you know, but for thousands of years after Eden, mating continued as a purely social and civil institution. So in other words, those so-called primitive people, tens of thousands of years ago, they could keep the inner life and the outer life separate. They weren't blurring them together. You know, they knew that it was a social and civil institution. It was an outer life thing, not an inner life fact. And how many times have I pointed out that's one of the reasons why the Revelation is here in the first place, why this book is in my lap, is because we aren't keeping those two separated. We keep turning ourselves inside out and trying to make the external world, the material external world, satisfy our spiritual desires, our expectations. Yeah?
Do you think, Chris, that could be, there's a theme that I remember you talking about some time back, but people really don't understand what spirit is. Yeah. For a lot of people, it's just spiritualized mind. Yeah. And their mind just goes,
right. It diffuses, right?
Yeah, and to them that's spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, and just, yeah, think about how a simple little statement in the book challenges that. You know, if you've come to believe, you know, basically because culture taught you this way, that to be spiritual is to be the most diffused of consciousness, right? You know, and of course, like I point out all the time, okay, yeah, just merely spiritual, that's your, you know, unity, right? You're spreading yourself out into the continuum, you're de-individuating, sure. Okay, but when they say, you know, just a simple statement that the spirit directs, you're going, oh, wait a minute, nothing that I've ever called spirit directs me. You know, I just like melt into a unity and bliss out. What do you, I mean, spirit, you know, if it directs, that sounds like something that's like prickly and grabs a hold of something and, you know, points it in a direction, right? You know, isn't that what the word direct means? Right. So just that, you know, and then to go a little bit more precise, like you were just saying, okay, and what is it directing? It's my mind. Well, that must mean it's not in my mind. And if it's going to direct it, it has to be effectively, in this sense, above my mind. And it's like, well, if it's above my mind, that means it's outside of my mind. What? Spirit is some sort of a fact in the external world? See, it's just, yeah. You know, if you actually follow that, you know, precisely, you know, you come to this startling conclusion that it's just the exact opposite of what, like you're saying, everyone thinks, that it's just some sort of very fuzzed out state of mind. You know, and very, very feelingful, you know, to boot. All right, so, yeah, just see, you know, notice how this is almost always the case. In just one simple little paragraph, they key so many precise things up, if you parse it all, and really reflect on it, and allow it, like I was saying, a lot of times allow a dissonance to occur. The revelators are often trying to set up a cognitive dissonance, you know, which they're hoping you won't just blow through, but you'll pause and try to get high enough to resolve. It's like, wow, these two seem to be contradictory, but I've come to appreciate that that can't be the case. It's got to be me. How do I understand this in a harmonized way? You know, like I've said many times, it's impossible to make progress if you don't first discover the conflict that you know, the resolution of which leads to the progress you seek, effort, struggle, conflict. Right? It's an inescapable process. Faith, determination, love, loyalty, and then and only then progress. So if you're going to progress in your relationship to the revelation, you have to first find a conflict that you have the courage to face, you know, and use that faith, you know, next is faith, use that faith grasp to do a chin up, right? Get yourself up a little higher where you have the objectivity to resolve it, or begin to resolve it. Okay, so you can see, you know, already, you know, where they're going to go in a lot of what we're going to read in this section. They want to draw that contrast between bottom up and top down, and not to belittle it as a bottom up phenomenon, but don't blur it. Basically turn yourself inside out and think that that this is something that's being literally manipulated by deity. Okay. All right. Let's see what they got here.
The likening of human associations to divine associations is most unfortunate. The union of husband and wife in the marriage home relationship is a material function of the mortals of the evolutionary worlds. True, indeed, much spiritual progress may accrue consequent upon the sincere human efforts of husband and wife to progress. But this does not mean that marriage is necessarily sacred. Spiritual progress is attendant upon sincere application to other avenues of human endeavor.
Right, and you know, I already kind of fleshed out, you know, some of those elements. That of why the Sethite priests made it a religious ritual. You know, they're bringing that out there. True indeed, much spiritual progress may accrue consequent upon the sincere human efforts of husband and wife to progress. Right, and the Sethite priests were trying to encourage that and, you know, spark that, you know, as a nuclear aspect of the relationship. Hold that up. But you see, in the very first sentence, like the liking of human associations to divine associations, you know. See, so it obviously is, you know, is exactly what I was just pointing out, right? That's the contrast, you know. Yeah, it's a bottom-up, it's not a top-down phenomenon. And everything gets very, unfortunately, muddled if you blur the two. And, say I stress, it's not just a little issue. It's most unfortunate. And you'll see they're going to double down on that. When they say most, they mean most unfortunate. Like they're saying, that relationship is a material function of the mortals of the evolutionary worlds, right? I mean, not only is it bottom up, but it's just in the first phase of your whole, you know, ascension career bottom up phenomenon. It's just on the nativity spheres. With the little qualification, if you're not talking about evolutionary mortals, okay, there is the issue with material sons and daughters, and we'll get to that in a little bit here. Yep.
Chris, do you think that, is this a Sethite priest after the default or before, do you think?
No, there are no Sethite priests before the default. The Sethite priests are, by definition, the phenomenon. Yeah. Not only that, but you know what's got Seth going was the death of his brother, Abel.
Abel, really?
Yeah. You know, if you go back and study that, the calamity that was the lack of a proper religious environment, you know, and Seth recognized, it's like, okay, I'm going to see to it that this doesn't happen again. I need to, you know, take on this task.
Do you think their genetics was already starting to creep south?
Well, early on, the Sethites are sound, very sound.
Eventually, later.
I mean, sure. Yeah, by the time you get to the Old Testament, right, there's a lot of confusion, right? Yeah, right. But early on, it's very integrous. This is kind of what they're stressing here, right? I mean, they, you know, these priests knew what they were doing. They weren't trying to usurp the marriage institution or anything like that, like current religions do. And
I just see kind of a similar thing in India with the whole tradition of the Vedas.
And again, just remember the base. Basically, that, you know, all of the kind of really definitive traditions that we can observe anywhere in the world, you know, most of those are really no more than 3,000 years old, even in India or something. You know, it doesn't go back very far, and a lot of them don't even go back remotely that far. You know, some things that strike us as being very ancient, it's like, well, actually, that cropped up in the 9th century, you know, or something like that. And you go, wow, really that recent? So. Some of these things are not very ancient, but okay. Back to this paragraph. It you know, again, when they say this does not mean that marriage is necessarily sacred. You're saying, oh, yeah, they're still in that mode. Okay, not divinely sacred. You know, and just, you know, why is spiritual progress attendant upon sincere application to other avenues of human endeavor? Because you're, by grace, human, right? Inescapably, there's a spiritual nature that's in play. And all you have to do to have that basic by grace encirclement in the Holy Spirit start to influence your day-to-day life is supply just a little measure of favorable conditions, right? Something like loyal, or something like humble, or something like, oh, sincere. All right. The sincere application, that's the key, right? It's that sincerity that prevents you from unconsciously using your free will to short circuit the influence of grace in your life. Yeah. Yeah, and notice, you know, it's interesting that we brought up the effort, struggle, conflict, etc., leading to progress, and here they're talking about progress, see, even in that next paragraph. You know, so when they say spiritual progress, don't be delusional. It's like, oh, I could just, like, think that, and boom, I'll be progressing. No, all progress is at the tail end of that 8-step process that begins with effort and struggle and conflict. You have to deal with all of the commotion, the philosophic commotion that conflict, you know, inescapably, forces you to face. You can't, it's a conflict because you have a false starting framework. That's why there's a conflict there. You need a better framework to think in. You know, and you don't just change the big picture, you know, the framework of your mind without disrupting everything. Right? So if this is any sort of a significant progress that we're talking about, the conflict is going to be significant. The disruption of the framework is going to be, you know, practically all-encompassing. Your whole life is going to feel like it's been turned upside down in order to achieve eventually that, you know, the peace that higher picture and the progress it allows. You know, you go through it a couple times and, you know, you recognize it's worth it, you know. Like, I'm willing to go through that conflict because it was so delightful to be able to actually progress, right, in my life, to not be stuck, you know, in this vicious cycle of repeating the same thing over and over again. And, you know, finally I've broken that vicious cycle and I've gone, taken a step forward. Okay, now, like I said, they're going to double down on when they said most unfortunate. See what they say next year.
Neither can marriage be truly compared to the relation of the adjuster to man, nor to the fraternity of Christ Michael and his human brethren. At scarcely any point are such relationships comparable to the association of husband and wife. And it is most unfortunate that the human misconception of these relationships has produced so much confusion as to the status of marriage.
Okay, before we get into details, notice they repeated the most unfortunate, but then they said that the human misconception, okay, they used the mis prefix, right? So I'm telling you this, you know, this is bringing issues of right and wrong in play, right? This is wrong. In other words, there's evil. There's disruption of unity. Not surprisingly, they're talking about how you're not keeping the spiritual and the material properly separated. So it's not surprising that it could have spiritual consequences. See, so when they say most unfortunate, you're left to just like, wow, I need to kind of think about this. They're saying that this literally can lead to a disrupting influence in my mind. The proper influence of that unity, that spirit on my mind, is being disrupted by what just seems to be my ignorance and confusion and some unfortunate initial assumptions. But it just reminds you that when all is said and done, it doesn't matter that it's all unconscious. Many religionists are unwitting secularists, but I'm unwitting. Yeah, but guess what? You're still a secularist, and you have delusions that what you are as a secularist is a religionist, right? And you've completely polluted, right, your whole frame of mind in this way. So, these things have consequences. And again, there wasn't an emergency way back when humans, because humans have always done this. Why is there an emergency now? Because we're not in the sheltered bay anymore, like they tell you. When they start to talk about religion, the nature of religion, you're not in the sheltered bay. You're out on the high seas now. Well, why am I in the high seas? I'm not ready for the high seas. Well, the Supreme just keeps marching along. The glacier pushes you forward. There you are. You better figure out where your compass and your charts are. Because you don't have the option of going back to the Blue Lagoon, and running around naked. This is not an option anymore. The fifth epical revelation is trying to get us to recognize this and yet not be afraid to face it courageously, these facts. It's like, I need to up my game. All right? I can't be so oblivious about these things. I need to take this more seriously. Recognize what's been put into my hands, and him too much is given as much expected. If I've been made more spiritual, I have a greater responsibility than someone 3,000 years ago, or even 200 years ago. Okay.
I don't know how you can read this book seriously, paper like you do, sequentially, and not come to that conclusion. It only took me two sequential reads in this class before I said, there's some things that I can't run away from.
Yeah. I've got to find the courage.
Realities.
Yeah.
One way or another, the planet's going to go in this direction.
Yeah. Yeah, and so there we are. Some of the details there. Notice how they give you both what they know your Rancho book readers are going to be want to do, and what Christians have been doing for 2,000 years. Likening marriage to, it's like, oh, well, that's just like Christ and the church. Christ is married to the church, and Christians love that analogy. And at scarcely any point are such relationships comparable, right? Not to mention the most unfortunate and the wrongness that they bring in. But then that whole thing of Well, that was immediately I was thinking about the relationship between me and my adjuster. Oh, they're telling me not to do that. Now, if you're on your toes, you should be going, but wait a minute. I remember a whole bunch of times when they said something about betrothal, when they talked about adjusters and their relationship to humans. What do you mean? Yeah, but they didn't say marriage. It's like, well, isn't it the same thing? You know, remember, there's been times when I've reminded you to think more literally about the word betrothal if they use that. Don't think, you know, don't grab some simplistic primitive notion from the external world and drag it inside, okay? What does the word literally mean, betroth? Be truth, right? You've come together in truth. The relationship has been betruthed, right, between you and your adjuster. It hasn't been befacted yet, right? You haven't fused it to your adjuster yet, but it's been betruthed, right? It's a betrothal. And see, if you don't go to that literalness, the etymological literalness of that word, you know, in 2 seconds, you'll be doing exactly what they tell you you're not supposed to do here. And, you know, how often do you come back and read this sentence to remind yourself not to do that? And, you know, do you, every time before you read the adjuster papers, do you go back and read this sentence to remind yourself not to get confused when you read the adjuster papers? Probably not. So
we call a mortal ever fusing with another mortal.
Yeah. But, you know, when all is said and done, I mean, again, what's the main, you know, why are they bringing that up? Because the marriage is a bottom-up phenomenon, right? You have definitive top-down, right? The adjuster is coming top-down and meeting you coming bottom-up, right? Christ Michael is coming top-down. He's a descending son meeting you coming bottom-up. Right? There is, you know, and there's literal divinity involved, right? Creator Son is divine. He's God. You know, not only is he divine, but he's personalized deity. He's God. An adjuster is divine because it's literally a fragment of deity. And the marriage doesn't have that in it. There's no innate divinity in it. It's not divinely sacred. See, and that's the fundamental thing. That's the To literally do that, to take something that is bottom-up and assume that it's top-down, is wrong. That's the disrupting influence.
Maybe you need to put it in perspective a little bit better. Over my lifetime, I've had a number of dogs. And I found that dogs are preparatory to having children. They teach you a certain responsibility and a certain loyalty.
Yeah.
And I think a relationship, a close relationship that you might have in marriage, also is kind of in the same bolt of fabric. It teaches you some measure of responsibility and some measure of loyalty.
Yeah.
And it also forms, although it doesn't form another person per se,
mm-hmm.
it forms an item, if you will. Because you're given the responsibility, if you have kids, of raising children properly. And you also have to represent yourself with this, with kind of the thought in mind that your other half, better or worse half, is attached to you socially. So you, it's kind of preparatory to loyalty and trust and truth and honesty.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an exercise preparatory to where you have to make even deeper commitments and deeper loyalties.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like having a dog.
Right. I mean, and see, and again, like I was pointing out, I mean, it's not like with the adjuster and man and Christ, you know, Michael and his human brethren, it's not like there isn't a bottom-up element there that is reaching up to exalted levels in order for the, you know, the top, to meet what's coming from the top down. You know, you have to literally get all the way to a, for a circler before, you know, you meet in a kind of more intimate way with your adjuster. That's a pretty exalted bottom-up state.
But
So, yeah, see, like you're saying, the you know, there is that in marriage, when they say most exalted, it has that very definitive high level, bottom up, that can have all kinds of very positive consequences to your, you know, how you handle your children and stuff. But just don't think that it also intimately has that top down element in it. You know, it's just you, you know. I mean, obviously, you're using your personality, your encirclement of the Holy Spirit, you know, in order to get up to those exalted levels. But it's not like the Holy Spirit is gluing the marriage together or something, right? Don't think that that there's a literal top down that's gluing, you know, or initiated the bonding in marriage. That's what they're trying to get you to appreciate. You know, and they're going to mention that literally here in just a second. That's the key, right? Like you're saying, I mean, you know, most exalted. I mean, I can't go any higher than that. So, I mean, there's no end to the positive consequences to a loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient consecration in marriage, and what that can do for the two, the kids, and the greater society. Obviously, there's basically no limit. That's why it's the home is the foundational institution. All of civilization is built upon that foundation. If you don't have the home, there is no civilization possible, period. You're going to be in some, you know, at best barbaric state, probably tending to savagery. You know, like, ooh, I know, free love, that's progressive. No, that's rank savagery, like they tell you, right? So you've gone all the way down when you think that the horde is the end and not the beginning concept. You got something, too?
Yeah, it's a horizontal relationship, not a vertical relationship, like I interpreted what you were saying.
Yeah, it's a horizontal relationship that produces a super additive consequence that brings in a vertical, but it's still a bottom-up vertical, not a top-down vertical,
right,
see?
Right. If you take the idealized person matches and like Adam, Addison, and Radha, you know, Radha having but one thought, I mean, she was at the very top of her mind. That's what she was doing. She was knocking at the spiritual. I think maybe you can look at that.
Yeah, and she also knew how sublime the coordination of the two of them was going to be.
Yeah,
she had no idea, you know, just how transcendent, you know, it would be that you would produce progenitors of secondary midwares even, you know, it was that exalted. But, yeah, and each recognizing the potential of the two halves coming together, you know, not just additively to make a whole, but super additively. Okay. All right. So there's, you know, we kind of have all of the sort of warnings and tension up front here. What else do they say?
It is also unfortunate that certain groups of mortals have conceived of marriage as being consummated by divine action. Such beliefs lead directly to the concept of the indissolubility of the marital state, regardless of the circumstances or wishes of the contracting parties. But the very fact of marriage dissolution itself indicates that deity is not a conjoining party to such unions. If God has once joined any two things or persons together, they will remain thus joined until such a time as the divine will decrees their separation. But regarding marriage, which is a human institution, who shall presume to sit in judgment, to say which marriages are unions that might be approved by the universe supervisors in contrast with those which are purely human in nature and origin?
Okay, before we go to that little footnote, kind of the last part of that, see, you know, setting aside divine action for a second, but just even that issue of, we know in reading the Urantia book that it's not like our immediate superiors aren't interested in these issues of the evolution of mankind and who might be married to whom and whatnot. You know, we even know at times there seem to be tweaking, you know, of things and whatnot. And you know, like you were just pointing out, coincidentally, Adamson, you know, had this childhood dream, you know, of going north, and he discovers the, you know, last remaining pure line Noddite female, and that's the only way we could have gotten secondary midwares, and well, every world has to get secondary midwares one way or another, and that's kind of an extreme case, but there's lots, you know, we know there's lots of tweaking of things, but even beyond just no tweaking and well up, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down on that marriage, even in those issues it's like, well, which marriages might the seraphim approve of, like the home seraphim. I remember there's those master seraphim, the home seraphim. You know, they might be very interested in these sorts of things, and you know, if not tweaking them, you know, and sometimes at least considering, it's like, well, that's kind of unfortunate, but okay, the evolution will take care of that eventually. All right, we can't even get into that, let alone the even greater presumption of, oh, well, I think that God the Father himself reached down, grabbed these two, and glued them together. What God has joined together, let no man put asunder. I mean, even the sentence is absurd, as if man could put something asunder that God has joined. But see, you know, that just reminds you of the delusional primitive magic thoughts where humans thought that they could do various things and wield God. Like if I say something in Latin, then God has to obey me. You know, or once I have, once I'm post-Jesus, I can conclude that Jesus is the supreme magic word. And if I invoke Jesus' name, well, I mean, the whole universe has to obey me then. We have all kinds of delusional notions like that. They're just adding that. It's one thing to think that in some sort of vague way there's a downwelling phenomenon that is intimately involved in making this happen. You know, that there's a downwelling and there's an upwelling, and the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two is a marriage. Okay? It's one thing to think that. It's even another thing to bring in personality action. You notice they didn't just say that it's divine, like divinely sacred, but divine action. So, in other words, there's not just deity, but personalized deity. And you notice they even remind you of that, where they say, but the very fact of marriage dissolution itself indicates that deity is not a conjoining party. You know, they're reminding you of the proper definition of divinity. It's not godlikeness, it's deity-likeness. It's more fundamental, if you will, than godlikeness. But we are talking about personalized deity, right? So then they mean, you know, if God has once joined. You know, so they're you know, just notice how sophisticated that is. You know, they're seeing if you've been following what we've read in the previous three paragraphs in a fifth epical way. When they're saying divine, are you actually thinking precisely, oh, they're talking about deity in play? And if not, you're kind of confused. It's like, well, weren't we already talking about this? Weren't they already talking about divine action? What do they mean? The other thing you can think about is divine action. See, that's the difference between the first paragraph, or the first section number one of the foreword, and section number two of the foreword. First there's deity, and second there's God. You know, those sorts of things. Now, go ahead, Joel.
I was just going to say that a lot of the confusion has occurred over the centuries as people have tried to mark important milestones in their life in a special way. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes what I've observed is that these special observations are facilitated or overseen by a holy man, so-called mm-hmm. holy man.
Mm-hmm.
For example, marriage is just one, but there's also baptisms. Mm-hmm. There's any number of of rituals.
Yeah.
And like you say, when your holy man speaks in a secret language, mm. is the language of divinity, of course, and when they especially clothe themselves right. with special clothes.
Got all the affectation happening.
All
yeah.
of the affectation.
yeah.
Now, what really drove this home to me was when I saw a Catholic marriage in deep down in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
It was presided over by three priests. Three of them, think about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, one was not adequate to the situation.
One was not adequate. Well, I'll tell you when they joined together. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, one of the things that they did is they had this bar and attached to it were all these little bells.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when they did something that was especially significant, one of the guys would go, shing!
Right.
And I thought, wow, what's this about? And then it dawned on me, these are special effects.
Yeah.
So it's a power grab. Mm-hmm. If you have something of significance in your life occur and you solicit the holy man, local holy man, he's in a position to say your loyalty to the church is synonymous with your loyalty to God.
Mm-hmm.
Be loyal to the church and observe your holy man because we got it covered.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of this confusion is attached to power grabs by the priests yeah. of the various religious sects.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and of course, you know, we've already read those specific details about this, you know, religion's presumption to, you know, to take a hold of marriage. You know, so all this is being said in the wake of that. But also remember, they also, you know, they were just reminding us of how important this false existentialization of marriage has been in keeping the marriage institution together. So, you know, right now they're speaking very definitively about how problematic this is. But don't forget, just recently they were talking about it as a positive, that you had all this false sacredizing of this and thinking of it as a sacrament. Yeah, so it's a they're reminding you of what I say all the time. All good things taken to extreme become bad. Right? There's a point in the evolutionary process where it's net positive to bring in this divine sacredness sort of notion to it. And just to prove that top-down action is there, the bell rings. Right, it's Christmas time. You probably remember a movie, something about a bell ringing, indicating that God was involved in some action. Right, right. This is a very ancient notion. And you're not supposed to think that the priest is ringing the bell. I mean, the action of God is coming through the priest, and the bell is ringing just to prove that God is in play. In the phenomenon. Right, all of these ancient notions that are now ritualized, but nonetheless, see, you're struck by, okay, that's all a net positive way back, but now that you've started to idealize marriage, this is a net negative. Back when it was just a very matter of fact material pragmatism issue. A lot of times that wasn't enough to stabilize marriage. So you needed this sort of false juicing of it, believing that it's sacred to help hold it together. But now you're bringing in spiritual energy, you as husband and wife, where I. You can, it's what they were saying. This you can be a misconception now. You can actually flip this around so that it's a net negative. It's actually putting an unnecessary tension into the situation that shouldn't be there. It should be taken seriously, but not hyper seriously. Like they're remember what they how they reminded us of that there. That such beliefs lead directly to the concept of the indissolubility of the marital state, regardless of the circumstances or wishes of the contracting parties. See, they purposely said contracting there to remind you. Okay, you can't so over-idealize this that it ceases, that it, in your imagination, it becomes purely a matter of spiritual idealism and there's no material pragmatism in play. Because what happens if you do that? Then if you don't have the two, there's no super additive consequence between the relationship between the two. There's no cosmic quality to it if it doesn't have material pragmatism and spiritual idealism. Right, and the very thing that you desire for the, sort of, if you will, providence, if you will, for the cosmos to kind of work with you and help this marriage out, that you kind of synchronize with the functioning of reality so that there's a little bit more coincidentally things are going okay, you know, quote unquote coincidentally. That can't happen if it doesn't have a cosmic character to it. And it ceases to have a cosmic character if you become basically self-righteous about this and cut yourself off. By making it hyper, idealized, you know, let's just say it that way, and not appropriately pragmatic, because it's an outer life thing, you know, as an institution. It's not an inner life institution.
Yep. Just say that this is a delicate issue, but their selves, what I thought right from the beginning, you describing that, their selves aren't really involved. They just immediately, it's kind of what they talk about in the religion papers when they talk about the adjuster that places a slight preference on the altruistic, a slight preference on the altruistic, but it doesn't ignore the personality value of the ego.
Yeah. Funny that you'd say that. See, you know, they're actually
they
going.
They're going to bring
that up.
Section, they yep. say people who have not. This is assuming that this child has had ego, a well-developed ego by the time he's age six.
Mm-hmm.
For those who didn't, it's a life of unhappiness and misery.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes,
yeah,
because they're, you know, they're not.
Yeah, and again, all those, like I said a little bit ago, all these issues are all the more in play now because we're innately more spiritual. You know, and like I said, I mean, there's so much in play and our ignorance is so great that there is literally an emergency, a philosophic emergency that mobilized super universe personalities to, you know, give us the fifth epical revelation. You can. There's a tendency towards egotism now that didn't exist in the past. Systemically, right? I mean, any given individual, okay, it can always be an exception, right, to the rule of any age, but systemically, right. All isms are more in play, including egotism. There's always, remember, you know, just a little aside on that, because by grace you're encircled in the Holy Spirit and given a personality, egoism, you know, is innate. And that's not innately negative, right? It's when you take that good thing to an extreme and it becomes bad. When it becomes bad, that's when you call it egotism. You know, and we've talked about that a lot. I mean, there's no distinction anymore. I mean, people don't even, not only do they use the distinction very, you know, hardly anymore between egoism and egotism, they don't even use the word egoism. They use ego as a synonym for egotism, you know, and ego is bad. No, that's like, you know, that's literally, to say that ego is bad is literally to say that the capital I pronoun is bad. Because that's what the word ego is, the capital I pronoun, right? It's the self-aware self.
That's why
people
often signing their name without capitals.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, lest they appear presumptuous. Yes, like no. I mean, you're a personalized self. You capitalize your name. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Meanwhile, back to marriage. Okay. So right. So just that. You know, in no way, shape, or form is marriage resulting from a downwelling phenomenon, be it just the functioning of deity or even personality action from above, right? Okay, so all that said, what do they want to tell us next? Let's see here.
Nevertheless, there is an ideal of marriage on the spheres on high. On the capital of each local system, the material sons and daughters of God do portray the height of the ideals of the union of man and woman in the bonds of marriage and for the purpose of procreating and rearing offspring. After all, the ideal mortal marriage is humanly sacred.
Ah, there we go. Finally. They literally stated it. So, and you see, like I said, you have all that stuff. It's like, oh, you know, and they know you're being driven into a dichotomy. So they have to begin the next paragraph with, nevertheless, okay, don't think that just because marriage isn't divinely sacred, that doesn't mean that there isn't an ideal of marriage. It's like, well, wait a minute. I thought those were basically synonymous ways of talking. Remember what I said up front? Ideal is not a word that's synonymous with divinity. Okay, the word ideal exists in a whole vertical hierarchy, downstepped. And notice here, they're pointing that out. You know, where is the height of this particular ideal? Is it on Salvington? Is it on Uversa? Is it? No, it's on Gerasim. Clear down there? Yeah, well, it's only clear down there that you actually have male and female made in a pattern form, you know, in a evolved, if you will, form, so that they can, you know, they serve as that pattern that everything is moving toward. Like we've talked about, you have all the planets in a local system with all kinds of different genetics, but all those can mate with the offspring of the same genetic Adam and Eve's, you know, material sons and daughters on the local system headquarters. And it's not that every planet, you know, it starts in very diverse ways. It's not that eventually every planet, when it's deeply settled in light and life, has genetics on it that's identical to the material son and daughter. The way to picture that is you have, you know, the original material son and daughter and all their offspring at the local system headquarters, and you have these various downstepped expressions of the genetics on the worlds in that local system. But don't think of that downstepping as purely vertical, so that, you know, if I evolve them back up, they're going to end right back there exactly like the material son and daughter. Think about it, when you downstep, you also differentiate, diversify outward. So it goes diagonally down, you know, when you downstep. So then, as it evolves up through, you know, the natural evolution, the biologic uplift, the genetic engineering, whatnot, and finally you get to light and life with these creatures, they're up at the level of the material sons and daughters, but they're spread out. So then when all is said and done in a local system, you've expanded that pattern genetics out into its full completeness, that they're a nucleus of a, you know, one-time complete horizontal expression. Okay. So, you know, they are the ideal. Even more so, you know, see the spiritual ideal, because of the way I just pictured that they're that nuclear-like point in what you're trying to build. It's like when we think about faith, you know, that spiritual faith, and how that's a nucleus point about which, for instance, you can picture a sphere of truth or a sphere of logic. Yeah. You know, that spiritual spark, that nucleus fact. See, they are that ideal. And so, you know, this challenges you then to reflect on the concept of ideals and to differentiate it from just you know, another way of talking about divinity, you know, or that which is divine. It's not. You know, you can match that ideal, like in this case, of the marriage between a material son and daughter, but you're a long ways from finite divinity, you know, that you are when you're a finaliter, all the way ascended all the way up to paradise. See, there's a huge separation between the ideal at its height, in this case, and divinity. Material sons and daughters aren't divine, but they are the height of the ideal of the union of man and woman. Okay, so just like I said, there's a sophistication, and I won't belabor that, but to just challenge you to, you know, it's like, well, what exactly is an ideal? How do I think about that? It's a fairly complex concept.
Okay? Well, yeah, a common misconception of idealism not only doesn't have a relationship to material pragmatism, but even requires one to disregard material facts.
Yep, right. Yeah, lest the material facts pollute it.
Exactly.
Yeah. As if the Isle of Paradise pollutes the eternal sun. Not quite. not hardly.
Where does divinity start? And it doesn't start at the local system level. Is it at the local universe level or in the...
Well, I mean, you have, you have divinity down at, you know, at quite low levels. I don't want to get too complicated here, but just, I mean, let's just think of it in ascending sun form. You know, think of it in, you know, subsequent humans, ascending mortal form. You know, what if you're a spirit fuser instead of a father fuser? You ascend up to a local universe perfection, and then subsequently you penetrate horizontally to a local universe completion. And you know, see, that's a downstepped expression of, as a father fuser, you ascend all the way up to the Isle of Paradise to perfection, and then you penetrate horizontally in the whole grand universe to completion, all seven super universes. And you know that, you know, you are literally finitely divine up there. So, you know, it's like, well, how do I think about down there below? You know that, like, for instance, Gabriel, who's just a local universe being, he's the highest local universe being apart from Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit, but you know he's divine, and you know he's also not deity. You know, he's not personalized deity, he's not God. But he's definitely divine, quite sublimely so. See, so that's that's, you know, giving you a sense of, oh yeah, there's this, there's a, you know, a relativity to this. You don't have to be all the way at the highest level to be divine. You know, and just to kind of remind you again of how you have to kind of think about this, you know, with a lot of complexity. It's like, well, okay, see, Melchizedek's, okay, they can never give badness form in their mind. So there's never evil with a Melchizedek. But they can give false, you know, hood form in their mind. And error is possible. Okay, so you can't say that they're, to begin with, divine. But now Verondadek, which, you know, you think, well, those are the ones the next notch down. Well, yeah, but they don't have that issue of error. So in terms of where they serve, they're one notch down, but in terms of that internal integrity, they're higher than a Melchizedek. Oh, yeah, they're the most highs. Right? See, so they have a divinity to them that the Melchizedeks don't have. They have a deity likeness. Again, that doesn't become, it isn't there because they're literally deity, the same way that Gabriel isn't literally deity. You know? But they're integrous. Yeah, I see. So you have to think about this very carefully, and you know, and recognize that, you know, that individual is, you know, those individuals at a low level, nothing is ever going to happen where they're going to go off course. See, so they're effectively divine.
Okay. Yeah. But now the power beings just real quick.
And the power beings are rock solid. You know, they're yeah. And life carriers, too. Life carriers don't join rebellions. Because, oh my goodness, if they did, that would be problematic. Right? They have to be integrous. Yep.
Melchizedek's have this, can express themselves over this divergence, so much lower down. And that must be the trade-off.
Yes, that is. Exactly. So you recognize that's in order for them to have that vertical flexibility where they can even literally manifest themselves materially, you know, like I was talking about, you got to picture a knob and they can dial a knob and, okay, now they're manifesting, you know, in corporeal fashion. Yeah, I mean, for them to have that vertical variability, it comes at the expense of a little measure of absence of internal integrity. If you lock the inside down too tightly, then it doesn't have the fluidity to, you know, to express itself over that vertical range like that. Yeah, so you can, you know, you can begin to get some sense of the physics of this, you know, and it kind of remind, oh yeah, divinity. See, that would be very locked down, precise. But then it's like, well, locked down in what sense? Are you like absolutely locked down, finitely locked down, absolutely locked down? Okay. Yeah. And that's what I said, that's where that bit of complexity comes in. And, you know, that it's very complicated because you have this hierarchy. It's so much more complicated to think about than the old model where there was just heaven and earth and everything in heaven was divine and everything on the earth wasn't. Okay. And nothing in between.
Except marriages.
Right. It's so complicated to think about now.
They still get it right, you know, at their level, but it's their very block consciousness. I'm not block consciousness. I'm the opposite. I dribble off the other way.
Okay. Okay. So anyway, yeah, back to this. Italicized humanly. It's humanly sacred. It's bottom up sacred. It's So if there was any confusion, they finally kind of just spell it out for you. Oh, that's what they were talking about before. The other stuff was divinely sacred. It's not divinely sacred. All right. Okay, I think we've played that plenty. Let's keep going here.
Marriage always has been and still is man's supreme dream of temporal ideality. Though this beautiful dream is seldom realized in its entirety, it endures as a glorious ideal, ever luring, progressing mankind on to greater strivings for human happiness. But young men and women should be taught something of the realities of marriage before they are plunged into the exacting demands of the interassociations of family life. Youthful idealization should be tempered with some degree of premarital disillusionment.
Yeah, so everyone remembers that classic line about premarital disillusionment. And it reminds you again, I mean, not only of the, you have to have spiritual idealism and material pragmatism in play, like we were saying before, but just saying youthful idealization. You begin with, an encirclement in the Holy Spirit and this potential to have insight, higher insight, but you don't have a sophisticated mind to begin with. And so it's very easy for you to have a very definitive belief that this is an ideal because it appears to be the ideal, but it isn't really. It's your initial vague sense. You have the ideal sort of in truth, but not in fact. And that, to get it definitively, clearly in front of you in fact, you need more than just that super consciousness relationship, right, to the cosmos. There has to be a conscious relationship that you're sort of in the driver's seat of. That genuine, fully matured recognition of the ideal is in that cosmic context. I mean, why is youthful idealism youthful idealism? It's because it doesn't have the full wisdom and insight and foresight in play. It isn't properly contextualized. It's abstracted, like basically just, immediately apart from any pragmatic thinking. It's, this ideal is a complete lifestyle solution. No. Yeah, that's the essence of the whole. It's not the whole itself. And you're too young to have gotten anywhere near the full picture that you need. You just have that initial spiritual spark, if you will. And you're ready to, your zeal is ready to run with it. Causality doesn't need to be considered. Right, I don't need anything from my first cosmic intuition. My third cosmic intuition is all I need here. Let's run. Well, what if you don't have the first in play, and you sort of run with the third? What do you get? Fanaticism. Right, you're going to be fanatical about marriage, and that's not going to go well. And so. See, that's the stuff they're getting in that whole, again, why did, when we're talking about marriage as, this ideal, this dream of temporal ideality, we're obviously hearkening back to the true monogamy section, right? That's the ideal. And the fact that that true word is there, right? That there's that full cosmic context that it's in. Right? That it isn't just the spiritual spark. It's the cosmic whole. So that it's true monogamy. And it's properly balanced. Yep.
I was going to say, to add to that confusion, and I have seen I've seen my kids dress up like they're getting married. You know, it's fun. And you know, when you're 5 years old, the idea of getting married is putting on a cool dress.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And having fun like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also observed that as people mature and they get in their late teens and 20s, if they're sufficiently devout to Christian beliefs that you can't have sex before marriage, they'll do anything to have sex. They'll do anything, including getting married, mm-hmm. to have mm-hmm. sex.
Yeah.
And it's a physical pressure that is absolutely amazing to observe
mm-hmm.
with late teens and early 20 mm-hmm. young people. They, you know, it's the ideational concept of solving all of your problems is kind of there, but the idea of taking somebody's pants off and doing stuff is so powerful. I mean, your first instinct is to stay alive, and the second is to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
And when you reach that ideal age of having sex, mm-hmm. if you don't get married and you don't have sex, you're in a real bind.
And of course, they were just, you know, remember, you know, you weren't here last week, but what we were just reading, you know, they were just talking about all that, you know, you have that sex urge and how that ideal of monogamy complicates that. It's like, well, what if you don't, you know, reach this ideal? You know, then what? You know, it's not like your sex urge goes away. Well, this is going to cause all kinds of social problems and, you know.
Well, yeah, peripheral and, to that, yep. kind of parallel, I have a question.
Yep.
Is there sex after death? something, facsimile.
There isn't literally, the material sex like we think of. There's something much better.
Yeah.
There's still liaison. Remember, another word that we have for sex is liaison. And the revelators say, yeah, let's go with that word. Now, recognize that that's a word that you can move up a hierarchy. You can't move up, you know, sexual intercourse up the hierarchy. It isn't that, you know, crude, you know, when you leave this world. But you can move the concept of liaison up the hierarchy. So much so, remember when you read about the Marantxa life, one of the first things they have to teach you when you have a Marantxa body and you have all of this ability to be intimate with others, you know, overlapping your Marantxa energy systems in ways that are very delightful, you know, like we interweave our material bodies, you know, in sexual intercourse. You know, that it literally is so intimate and so possible to have a liaison that they have to teach you proper etiquette. Otherwise, you'll rape people, quote unquote. You know, you literally can do something with that liaison that is like the misuse of physical sex. You know, it's effectively a Marantxa raping of another person to get yourself in their business that intimately, you know, and to not follow the protocols. So, yeah, there is, and that goes all the way up, there is liaison and overlapping of energy systems, you know, that is much more intimately possible, you know, than... Well, these two localized parts get together, but the rest of you aren't. Well, no, you know, what if you just kind of overlap your whole bodies, you know, in some sort of a very intimate, you know, molecular level liaison? Whoa, what would that be like?
You know, along that line, and I don't know how many people are Trekkies, but there was an episode where Captain Picard and Dr. Crusher were kind of put on to this situation where they could kind of read each other's minds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was a sexual tension at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very sensual episode mm-hmm. in that regard.
Right,
and
right.
they very much regretted when they lost that capacity.
Yeah. See, and that's the thing about you can kind of appreciate what they're talking about with that Marantxa thing, because you can kind of sort of think of Marantxa substance as kind of like mind-made substance. Mm-hmm. And so same way you can visualize two minds sort of overlapping, you know, like we often tell in stories, you know, or maybe even have some experience of, because we can do it a little bit. Again, like, think of your whole body as like that, and you know, and can be in such an intimate liaison together as one. And that, you know, and seeing, and, you know, and so we can challenge ourselves to try to imagine that. And then there's all the stuff we can't imagine above that. What about when you're a first stage spirit? You know, what must a liaison be like then? Or what about when you're a finaliter? You know, or, you know, very, very profound. And the higher you go, the more that overlapping can produce not only sort of like in, you know, an internalized superadditive consequence, but that superadditive consequence can be literally external. Oh, there's a creature trinitized son, right? You do like, you know, say the prince's staff did, you know, whoops, there's a primary midwayer, right? That superadditive consequence literally takes body form and gets personalized as another person. You know, it's so literal. You know, those liaisons, you know, way up there on high between finaliters and Avona natives, or between two finaliters or whatnot. See, you know, they're having sex, quote unquote. That's a liaison that's literally producing an offspring of a creature trinitized son. You know, and you can only attempt to imagine how incredibly transcendent that feeling must be in that liaison. You think sex is cool. You know?
Or even when you get to the finaliter, I think it's finaliter, that the two people become as one, not to everybody else, not to themselves, but is that how it works or something?
Yeah, right. You could just remember how they speak in terms like I'm saying. Think of it literally, you know.
Yeah.
There's this literal melting together. This, you know, that a literal liaison. You know, is like, you know, think of it in any analogy you want, but think in some very intimate analogy. You know, that it's not as absolute, if you will, as fusing with your adjuster. You aren't literally melting together like that, but it's obviously going to be pretty close to that when you're way up there as a finaliter.
To die for.
Yeah. Actually, you'll die many times before you finally get to that. Not to mention that final unconscious transition to the Isle of Paradise. Okay. All right, so anyway, back to this again. You know, she's just holding up that concept of an ideal, like you hold up the concept of monogamy, and then challenge yourself to go from the youthful thing, you know, or the simple thing. It's like, well, monogamous like mallard ducks. It's like, no, more profound than that. Make it true monogamy, you know, not just the two objects, you know, follow each other around, but somehow they synchronize with the cosmos. They have this cosmic, this super additive consequence of how they come together. You know, and see, ideals, you know, think of it the same way, that you're a genuine spiritual ideal is a true ideal, right? It isn't. Don't abstract it apart from the rest of reality. You know, everything is genuinely a triunity of matter, mind, and spirit, you know, or individuality, associativity, and unity. And you're seeking that unity of the ideal along with individuality and associativity, and it's a triunity, wholeness. And then it won't be youthful idealism. You know, it'll be the idealism of an adult of God instead of merely a child of God. Okay.
The youthful idealization of marriage should not, however, be discouraged. Such dreams are the visualization of the future goal of family life. This attitude is both stimulating and helpful, providing it does not produce an insensitivity to the realization of the practical and commonplace requirements of marriage and subsequent family life.
Yeah, I've already said that. See, again, just don't divorce it from the material pragmatism. And you know, even though it starts out that way, kind of just inescapably, abstracted from the practical. But don't squelch it, like they're saying. You know, see it not as an unfortunate end. It's an immature beginning and a necessary beginning. And so just make sure that they're supplying the favorable conditions that they're growing. You know, and they'll be growing so that it isn't merely this abstracted, idealized thing, you know, with no practical foundation to it. It's just like you want to eventually be a definitive personality, and your personality is absolutely unique. So you need to be very definitively individuated when all is said and done. You know, you certainly can't be a drop of water melted into an ocean and be a person, right? You have to be definitively individuated. It's like, well, if that's where I'm headed, I shouldn't be surprised if I start out as a material creature, kind of just innately quite individuated. I start out on an immature first level of meaning with selfishness. And probably my first word, if it was, you know, maybe it was mom or dad or something, but it, beyond that, it was mine, right? You start out in that very self-centered mode. It's like, well, why would God start us out like that? You know, that seems like that's a bad thing. No, it's just an immature fact. You eventually need to be very, very individuated in order to be a full-on person. So all you need to do is just improve that individuality. It starts out selfish. But the answer to selfishness is not de-individuation. It's self-mastery. All those sort, you know, that's the kind of essence of what they're getting at there, and not discouraging that useful ideal. Don't squelch it. Just like you don't say, shut up, kid, when they say why. And that's one of the worst things you can do is squelch the why question. You just short-circuited the philosophic life of that child, doomed him to a flatlander life. A life without the why question is not really a life. So that's a horrible thing, you know, when parents impatiently squelch that. Okay.
Be a miss in front of it.
Yeah, there's definitely whatever word we use needs a miss prefix in front of it, yes.
The ideals of marriage have made great progress in recent times. Among some peoples, woman enjoys practically equal rights with her consort. In concept, at least, the family is becoming a loyal partnership for rearing offspring, accompanied by sexual fidelity. But even this newer version of marriage need not presume to swing so far to the extreme as to confer mutual monopoly of all personality and individuality. Marriage is not just an individualistic ideal. It is the evolving social partnership of a man and a woman, existing and functioning under the current mores, restricted by the taboos, and enforced by the laws and regulations of society.
Right. I mean, you can't see again, you can overplay this. And no, it's just you and me, and there is nothing else that needs to be considered. Okay, well, that's problematic enough in itself, but it goes even beyond that, like they're pointing out. You know, it becomes this monopolistic situation where, you know, one or both of them has a nose ring. You know, and, you know, it's like, okay, you can be gone for 5 minutes, but that's all. And then you have to be back here. Remember, you don't have a life of your own anymore, right? Right, that, you know, we all have seen that, you know, play out in marriages where, you know, like what they're talking about there. It's like, no, you have to appreciate that this is part of a greater social construct. This isn't some island universe that you've established. And again, the over-existentialization tends to turn it into this island universe phenomenon where you need to just, you know, you don't have any friends anymore. You don't have anything. All you have is me. Don't you forget that. Right? That, you know, so sad when you see that playing out in relationships. That's what they're talking about. It's not just an individualistic ideal. All right. Remember when we talked about true monogamy, you know, and they bring in equal rights there. You know, remember that's the spark again. It's not delusions that there's physical equality or mental equality. Right? There's only one genuine equality, and that's spiritual equality, and that's the spark. Allows for the eventual harmonization of mind and body. The diversity of mind and body can be harmonized, but only if that harmonization is potentialized by both individuals taking a hold of what they have genuinely in common, that spiritual equality. Okay. So just reminding you of that again. And obviously that, you know, it's because of that spiritual quality that you can appropriately talk about ideals, right? You know, relative to this relationship. If there wasn't a spiritual fact in play, any talking about any use of the word ideal would be delusional. Ideal's a spirit word. Okay.
20th century marriages stand high in comparison with those of past ages, notwithstanding that the home institution is now undergoing a serious testing because of the problems so suddenly thrust upon the social organization by the precipitate augmentation of women's liberties, rights so long denied her in the tardy evolution of the mores of past generations. Presented by the Chief of Seraphim stationed on your ranch.
Okay, the key thing I want to highlight there is, you know, the way they say precipitate augmentation there. And then help, you know, with what they say after that to kind of help you think it through properly. Just think about how this worked. Instead of having the gradual improvement of this, which is best, instead, you had a long denied, you had this, you know, tardy situation. So that instead of it going gradually, you know, just the tension builds up and builds up until finally, in a very precipitate way, boom, you know, we bring the concept of equality into play. And, you know, when you don't have it gradually, when there's this kind of fiat implementation of something, it you know, think about how you kind of smack the system, and there's all these this ringing that goes out and disrupts things when you hit it hard like that, and so you know it's precipitate, like they're saying. There's no one thought through all of the secondary consequences of just, boom, today let's just, you know, implement, you know, equality in this regard, say. You know, because you're just doing that by fiat, you know, all of the corollary things that normally evolve into place are not there. And so you have all of these unexpected consequences. It's not that you shouldn't have done that, but the way you did it is not wise. It would have been much better if you had, you know, maybe you're still going to do it in relatively short order, not drag it out over a long span of time, but you need to think about a whole bunch of other things too at the same time. You got to change this and that and that and this and the other thing over there, and okay, because it's a complicated system. And you throw a whole bunch of things out of whack when you just plop this into the picture.
Well, yeah, that's true in part. Yeah. But When you smack the system and you see these ripples going out, it's kind of like straightening your spine. Feels good.
Oh, yeah. See, I mean, yeah, it's
furthermore,
it's, yeah.
What I would say yeah. is, I'm quite honestly, I am tired of old, white-haired, white men running the world. And I would, and every time a woman gets elected to Congress or the Senate or something, I think that is absolutely positive because it brings a mixture that has been sorely needed in temperament
of course.
Right. And judgment.
Yeah, again, don't misunderstand me. I'm not speaking in a dichotomy here, but just everyone has to appreciate that because we did it in a precipitative fashion, it's not that we shouldn't have done it in a precipitative, you know, it was so tardy, it really kind of needed to just be done because we need women in the system. That's, you know, not having them in the system is part of why the emergency is developed, okay? But we all just have to recognize that there's going to be all kinds of complications, okay? We can't be, you know, rose-colored glasses about this. We all have to recognize because we did some of these things in such a precipitate way, we have to be ready to handle all of the other social complications that come into play. Marriage, you know, is going to be complicated by this and all kinds of things. Okay, just everyone has to be just, you know, open up your eyes. Don't view this with youthful idealism. Oh, this is all just going to be wonderful. No, it's going to be very challenging to deal with all the consequences and like you're saying, it's sometimes. See, when all is said and done, we'll look back and we'll recognize that it had to be done in that very wringing way on this planet because. It's only in the face of the disruption that that ringing causes that certain things can come into existence, right? And there's nothing bad about it. It's just challenging. Yeah, and that's basically everything on this world is like that. I mean, we're sort of just, you know, inescapably, most things are going to be as disruptive as it can be. It's a decimal world. It was a rebellion. There was a default. I mean, all these things
decimal
just...
Decimal planet where...
Yeah. Right. It's just...
Will comes much earlier.
Much earlier. And all these things.
You're going to get a more... Right. You know,
it's just a...
It's going to be a smooth... You know.
It's a very complicated world. And so when your idealism goes, why would God make life so problematic? Okay, remember what world you're born on. You know, you're born on an Agendonner world, you know, a challenging world where for all kinds of reasons, things happen in these very, whoa, now for something totally different ways. And we're all trying to play catch up then and dealing with it. You know, you have to just face that fact. You can't expect the normal gradually world where everything moves so slowly forward that it filters out into the whole system and everything is all kind of on the same page. And, you know, like we talk about, it's everything's kind of a narrow bell curve and moved very methodically forward and there's no big tensions in the system. We're the antithesis of that. You know, and so you have to remind your spiritual consciousness that that's not bad. It's just different. You know, it's very not Havona, but that doesn't make it bad, okay? That it's going to be very challenging, you know, to all kinds of very, very social constructs and institutions. Yeah.
Not to mention the profound upsides to have come from that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a
yeah.
potential opportunity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just so, see, we have a potentialized system like few worlds. Right? There's potentials waiting to be actualized here that most worlds will never have the opportunity for those actualities because they're the potentialities are not on those worlds. Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So now anymore, because, you know, I mean, you know, when I first started reading the book and then you get involved with people, they're all coming from part four, mm-hmm. you know, even we did when we started reading, you know, mm-hmm. and they're basing it, the book tells you to do it the opposite direction. And so that's a background. It's,
yeah.
You need to consider that when you're considering marriage here,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, you can see how the whole book, exactly, the book is constructed where before we focus in on a detail, we need to set the context. Right? And there's a whole hierarchy of that. You start with a very big context and you kind of focus in a little bit, you know, and get that context, and then focus in a little bit more and get that context, and you know, and it is in that order, because it's not the fourth epical revelation, which was we're not going to deal with the context, we're not going to deal with the mother, we're just going to focus in on the nucleus center point of the Father and prime the pump, you know, get you really started. We'll deal with the context later, right? You know, and see, and that's what the fifth epical revelation is about. It's like, okay,
yeah, you, precipitousness.
Yes, right, yeah, there. Yeah. You take the Father, you know, so that, you know, it's like, well, how can I take the Father to the next step? How could there be something besides, beyond the fourth epical revelation of God the Father? You know, if I've followed that properly and I've gotten precisely focused in on that center point, it's like, well, now that you have that nucleus point, that's not everything. What you found is not God the Infinite. You found God the Father. And there is no God the Infinite, okay? He and you and everything else exists in a context. It's like, well, who's in charge of the context? Like, say, existentially. You know, you have this existential Father. Who's in charge of the context that that part is in? What's the context for the seven absolutes of infinity? I've got seven parts, but what's their context? And who's in charge of it? Oh, there's this eighth fact called the Paradise Trinity that supplies an existential context. You know, and et cetera, like we talk about all the time. See, that, in, you know, to taking the Father to the next level is to say, okay, now you know him in and of himself, but now you need to know him in his context. Now you need to know him qualified. Now you need to be told he's not God the Infinite. You're not going to make the colossal error of capital P pantheism. All right? You're going to bring in all the other details so that you can take your understanding of the Father to the next level. You can't reveal the Father beyond what the ideal of the Father that Jesus revealed without revealing the Mother. You need the context, right? He's a part of a cosmic system. You're a part of a cosmic system. And this distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole, the Paradise Trinity, and through the individuality of the whole, the Mother. Without the Mother, there is no relationship to the Father, except a delusional, magical one that you could believe. No real relationship, no genuine relationship. Yeah, I mean, see, we keep coming back to that. It's so important, you know. That's why I keep stressing, like I was doing there. You have these nuclear elements, but yeah. But what's the bigger context it's in? Because if you take, like I said, if you start with that spark and then falsely ismize it, assume it's a complete lifestyle solution, assume it's everything. They call that a colossal error. Okay? Even when that one, that part that you're making everything is the first source and center of all things and beings, right? It's still just a part. You know? And then even when they get you that, they tell you, well, and then there's stuff that's way beyond the Paradise Trinity. It's like, oh my goodness, now I'm really, you know, I'm getting lost now. What are you talking about? That there's facts in existence that in which the seven absolutes are negligible in scope. It's like, well, wait, I thought they were all infinite. Okay, we all know it goes very, very far, but at least you have to get to that basic beginning of nothing exists unto itself. Everything exists in a context. Not even the first source and center of all things and beings exists unto himself. He exists in a context. And as soon as he came into existence, the first thing he did is put himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, the whole. He didn't say, I don't care about anything else. I'm not just a part. I am everything. No, he humbled himself and said, I'm going to be just a part. Right? I'm going to put myself in subordination to the whole. And everything else has to do likewise if it's going to be godlike. Okay, I think we have enough time here. We can do the preface here to the next paper. Let's get into a little bit. This is there's a lot of meat in this preface, so that'll fill out the rest of the time here.
Paper 84, Marriage and Family Life. Material necessity founded marriage, sex hunger embellished it, religion sanctioned and exalted it, the state demanded and regulated it. While in later times, evolving love is beginning to justify and glorify marriage as the ancestor and creator of civilization's most useful and sublime institution, the home. And home building should be the center and essence of all educational effort.
Okay, if it wasn't, strong enough, like I pointed out when they started out Section 8 there with marriage, which culminates in the home, and I was talking about the home. Look at him. Now we're definitely getting that. That's the whole point of the third of these three papers, is to very directly bring in the home. And so that's how the paper starts out. And like I stressed before, it is the foundational element of all of civilization, period. If that isn't clear enough, look what they say in that last sentence. And home building should be the center and essence of all educational effort. Wow, what a statement. Okay, yeah, we're not talking about all educational effort about marriage. No, we're talking about all educational effort. It's like, well, what sense does that make? Well, what did we just say? I mean, if it's the foundational element, it doesn't matter what you're talking about, science, government, whatever, all of those civilizational aspects are predicated on the home. And that should be, allow yourself to be confused about that, it's like, can you explain that a little bit more to me exactly? Okay, how is science, tied to that? They're just about to mention it. But just to take that, see the fullness of that. And so think about, the fact that this book is only in my lap because there's a civilizational emergency. And if the foundation of civilization is the home, maybe that's where the emergency starts. Maybe I'm knocking the foundation out from underneath the skyscraper, and I'm going to believe that the skyscraper will still stand, that we can all still live in the penthouse apartments? No. No. It'll go straight down like the World Trade Center towers. Right? The whole edifice of civilization will collapse. They hinted that at the end of the preceding paper. The home institution is now undergoing a serious testing. Okay? And, then what we were just talking about. Oh, but, there was all these things that we needed to do. Yeah, we did. But recognize that a number of things are threatening to break the foundation. The whole edifice will collapse. So, this is where you begin to really recognize, like we said, why is the chief of Seraphim writing these papers? Especially since the chief of Seraphim is, in our special world, is a primary Supernaphim. Why? Is he the one that knows of that which he speaks for these papers? Remember what we pointed out. I mentioned it earlier tonight. If nothing else, you know, he's the head of that group that manages the, you know, the Master Seraphim, right? And the Home Seraphim, or one of those divisions of Master Seraphim. It's all kind of coming together here. You begin to really appreciate why, you know, why they're focusing so much on marriage. There's more in play than merely marriage. You know, in them trying to help us out with thinking about it more objectively, more philosophically, more wisely, insightfully, more properly.
Okay. Truth to it.
It just, see, and there we can't lose sight of this, because everything else that we imagine about progress in government or world peace or whatever the heck, you know, you get very focused on some scientific achievement or something, none of that is going to happen if civilization collapses, because the home collapses.
Yeah. If you look at this a little differently, form follows function.
Mm-hmm.
And if you kind of read the sentence backwards, it makes it's a little easier for me to mm-hmm. perceive it, because mm-hmm. you're talking about home as it influences all educational applications. Mm-hmm. I think raising my own children, education took many forms besides going to school, going to high school or middle school or whatever, but it was peripheral to an overall education as to what is expected of you as an individual. Both of my kids went to kindergarten, and after they went a couple days, they said, okay, that was good, I'm tired of that, let's do something else. It was part of the education of them that they had commitments and responsibilities, and this was part of it, to go to this place and to learn things. And associated with that was the responsibilities of taking that education and maximizing your ability to not be a fool and to understand your world. And to understand how to use that knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, if you do that successfully and the kids work at it and they do what you're told, what they're told to do, and you tell them to do the right things, they grow up with the capability of doing all of the things that you're talking about, and that is building a successful society. They learn tolerance, and they learn individuality and self-integrity, and they learn how things work, and they learn how to appropriately interact with the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take the home and associate it with all of the educational efforts that are made, it makes a lot of sense, because those are extensions of the home, but the home does instruct children how mm-hmm. to do things that are important for a social structure, but mm-hmm. maybe not in the traditional context of where you stand up and say, this is a man and this is a woman, and you get married and you have babies and et cetera, et cetera. You don't have flow charts quite like that. They're much more complicated and much more subtle. But form does follow function.
Yeah, yeah. See, so I mean, what you're, you know, one of the things you're getting at there is, it's like, okay, so Chris is emphasizing and hyper-emphasizing the home, and okay, but it all seems kind of abstract. I mean, maybe the issue is, what exactly do we mean by home?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
See? Yeah, and that's obviously one of the things that we want to be looking for, is an enriched, expanded understanding of what that word can designate. You know, we already, you know, say, well, it's not just a house, it's a home, for instance. You know, and it's like, well, you know, Revelation is saying, you know, now just keep in that mode, expand out and see just how significant a concept that word can designate. Try to imagine, even though it's unimaginable, what that word designates on a world settled in light and life. Remember, you know, we can't even imagine what that word designates on a normal world in the post-pastoral Sun Age. The home is a factor that's completely beyond our imagination. Everything in a post-pastoral Sun Age is completely beyond our imagination, let alone a world of light and life, like I say all the time. Let's focus on this element. What can that word designate? Like, it's like, what could the word symbol L-O-V-E designate? Is it only a synonym for sexual intercourse? Kind of bring it into play with what we're reading here? Or is there a higher potential for that four-letter word? What about this four-letter word, home? You know, that's what they're challenging you to see if you can take that word up the levels of meaning and see it in an ever bigger concept. Okay. Okay. And then the other elements we have there, you know, they were kind of giving you in the beginning there that whole stepping through it quickly. You know, like we mentioned, the sex hunger embellishes it. You know, and on religion and the state and all these things come into play. It's kind of interesting the way they say it's only when you start to move the word love up the levels of meaning, it's beginning to justify and glorify marriage. Justify. See? To actually bring it into conformity with the laws of the cosmos. Because the individuals have gotten love up to higher levels of meaning. Okay, so they're kind of, it's another way of thinking about a lot of what we've talked about with this, you know, that spiritual equality has to be there as a spark for the trueness of the phenomenon. Okay, let's see, what else do they say here in this preface?
Mating is purely an act of self-perpetuation associated with varying degrees of self-gratification. Marriage, home building, is largely a matter of self-maintenance, and it implies the evolution of society. Society itself is the aggregated structure of family units. Individuals are very temporary as planetary factors. Only families are continuing agencies in social evolution. The family is the channel through which the river of culture and knowledge flows from one generation to another.
Let me just start with the last thing first there, because that's what we were teasing. Now, see, the family is the channel through which the river of culture and knowledge flows from one generation to another. Why should home building be the center and essence of all scientific educational effort? You know, like we were saying, you know, for instance, and they said all educational effort. You know, why would science be involved, right? Well, what does the word science mean in Latin?
Knowledge.
Right? Channel through which the river of culture and knowledge flows from one generation to another. Science is a key element of civilized people. Right? How does it get passed from one generation to another? Some abstract, magical, I know. There isn't the family in the home. Don't expect that science to go forward. Yeah. So, like I said, they were just about to kind of give you some initial hints about just how key the family is. And it's not individual, like they're stressing. You know, each of us as an individual is here today and gone tomorrow and really basically irrelevant to the grand scheme of the evolution of, you know, humanity on this planet, no matter how much we want to believe otherwise. Individuals are very temporary as planetary factors. Only families are continuing agencies. And they're going, well, my family, we're all going to die in short order too. No, they're taking the word family up a notch. They don't just mean this immediate collection of blobs of protoplasm. Right, they mean something that has a thread of truth flowing through it, not just a temporal fact. Right? A family is something that spans time. Right, and the home spans time with it. See, that's the channels through which. Right, see, so just there you can see how taking these things up a notch is bringing in truth. So that there's a thread. Right, that transcends any moment in time. That's one of the things they're getting at. True homes, true families. See, like that true monogamy. Right? bringing the truths of eternity into relationship with the facts of time. So you don't just have something that's just exists, you know, at a point in time.
Yeah. Well, does that get magnified in the context of advancing planets?
Mm-hmm.
You've got a lifespan, and you've got tremendous. These aren't just channels; these like corridors.
Right.
Family
units. Right. Right, by the time you get to light and life and people are living 500 years, you know, and you can just think about how that gives a potential for this to be so much more significant, a personality-managed phenomenon. Yeah, this is the stuff they're wanting to, you know, kind of get your juices flowing and thinking about. Not to mention, notice how they brought in the three. You were mentioning about how, you know, teach us about all the civilization stuff before they talk about this. You know, they talk about self-perpetuation, self-maintenance, self-gratification. All right, so they're bringing those in. And the distinction. Mating is purely an act of self-perpetuation associated with varying degrees of self-gratification. Everyone kind of gets that.
This sounds like something that somebody in the Big Bang would say to get his girlfriend in bed.
Yes. But you know, you see how they bring in the home building thing they're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. That how that innately brings in the material pragmatism, right? Largely a matter of self-maintenance, right? And it implies the evolution of society and all those things. You know, the aggregated structure of family units is a society. Whoa! So back before there was family. Before, you know, it was just a horde. Okay, technically, so you don't even have a society then. And that society, culture, civilization thing. I mean, that's really see pre-society, you can say. The fifth adjutant really is not doing anything very profound if it hasn't even led to family units yet. Okay. All right, then the final paragraph here.
The home is basically a sociologic institution. Marriage grew out of cooperation and self-maintenance and partnership and self-perpetuation, the element of self-gratification being largely incidental. Nevertheless, the home does embrace all three of the essential functions of human existence, while life propagation makes it the fundamental human institution. And sex sets it off from all other social activities.
Okay, so you can see before they are going to launch into the specifics of the sections, they again wanted to stress that, you know, that when we're talking, you know, very much when we're talking about the home, we can't just be thinking in this very island universe sort of a fashion. You know, you have to bring in the whole big picture of society. If you're going to understand what home is supposed to be about, it's not an end in itself. You know, it's a means to all ends. And you have to see it as a source point like that in order to properly understand it. It's an origination mechanism for civilization. Anything else there? Oh, just yeah, the final little comment here for as we wrap up. The very last thing they want to remind you of is what we've talked about many times. The thing that makes this all so complicated here, it's the home has all these this fundamental aspects like we've been saying and everything, but then you throw this monkey wrench into the whole thing of sex. Okay, and the powerful biologic energies, like you were saying very early on, you know, somehow the marriage and the home have to be all these great civilizational, you know, originators, but it's so easily blown up by the completely inconsiderate urge of sex, the sex urge that we have. So it makes this a very complicated institution. And you know, see, so they want to remind you of that. And not only does it set it off from all other social activities, you know, but it you know, it's just always the elephant in the room, right? The elephant in the china shop that can just mess everything up. When they give you that, it again reminds you why they devote three papers just to this issue of marriage and family, and you know that they didn't blend it in with other stuff. There's so many things that sort of demand that it be set apart and focused on specifically, you know, by itself, and you know, none of us can reflect on this too much. I hope everyone, you know, appreciates that from what I've been saying tonight. I mean, this is just so critical, and it's so concerning when you see the various influences that are disrupting the home, whether it be the laws that we ignorantly pass or whatever, all the various things that you know, mitigate the effectiveness of the home or even militate against its existence. It's a very central aspect of the entire fifth epical revelation. It's the center and essence of all educational effort. You know, what else do you, you know, what more do you have to say to that point? Okay, so we'll get into the details next time. You know, you see, they're going to kind of start us out again at the primitive level and move us forward. But now we want to really focus on the home aspect. So let's take a moment here, everyone.